so far it's council. Okay, Rabbi Osair, I think maybe what we should do today is integrate the elements of our sixth Echa meeting over here with the parasha, because anyway, the Shira had a lot to do with the commonality of Torah to Echa. So, we get the Rabbeinu Barucha. So, first we started off with the fact that the Chumash Devarim is unique, other than Bereishis itself, in that it starts without a vav. Instead of saying ve'ela, says ela. All the other chumashim begin with a vav. Obviously, Bereishis doesn't start with a vav because it's not continuing anything, but everything else is supposed to be a continued saga, and to indicate that these are not separate books, but they're all part of the overall saga of Bereishis. So the chumash begins with a vav. There's two reasons we pointed out, and both of them are actually mentioned by the Rabbeinu Barucha. One is obvious, why this chumash is innately different than any other chumash. The other one is less obvious. The one that's obvious is that these words, Ela Dvorim Asher Dibir Moshe, are not the words of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So although they're dictated to Moshe as the words of HaKadosh Baruch Hu to write in the Sefer Torah, like the rest of Torah, and that's what gives them the din of Torah, but they are written as the words of Moshe rather than as the words that HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe. And therefore, as Ramban points out, it doesn't say by Dabar Hashem or Moshe Lemor, it doesn't say Dabar El Bnei Yisrael, and you don't have over here the type of chidushim that you have in the other, in the rest of the Torah. And because of that, in other words, most of the mitzvahs that you have are reviews.
A lot of the mitzvahs.
Yeah. Ramban said, that's what we have to discuss as we go through here. Sometimes the mitzvahs are also the mice.
But not at the same time. Because it's not the same type of chidush.
That's what Ramban says, that it's not coming out of nowhere. It's coming out of something that was already given before. This is seeing it in this new light. It ends up as a new mitzvah. It's not a daber of b'nei Yisrael, the amartal, and so on and so forth. Just open up a new circuit. Okay, so I understand that makes a tremendous difference. Rabbeinu Barucha has a much more fundamental insight into the nature of what the whole chumash is meant to be, which takes the vav away. At least it's Meramis that takes the vav away, the Sefer Torah, that's what takes the vav away. And what he points out is that the Iker issue of Chumash Devarim discusses things that have not happened. Discuss ultimate Geula, the Brises that we find over here, are Brises for Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael that has not yet been achieved. And so he says, opposed to, and then he goes through, in other words, what the levels of the limud are of the first chumash, in terms of emunah, in terms of nationhood, geula, and things like that. Abeda. And then he says, after this, you have nityachei hasefer hazeh. That's why I say he's saying nityachei, because it's unique, it's singular. Shehu ela hadvarim. Since the two Batei HaMikdash, which were in our past, did not represent the real Iker Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael. It's only Ki'im B'Gu'ulah Akronah She'in Acharei HaGalut. Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, by definition, should be free of Galut. In other words, a Yishuv that is over is not really a Yishuv. Because it's not attaining an actual state of Menuchah and Arkama. You know, technically you can call Shiloh or Bati Alomi Menucha or Nachala, but Menucha bin Nachala you don't have, and therefore it's not the real Yishuv. The Kakra Tzalak Tzom the Sefer Azesh Kedah Bebis Akob the Gula Akona Shehi Ki Inyan Kiddush Olam. I'm suggesting that the reason that he's saying Shehi Utein Kiddush Olam, which puts it back into Sefer Bereishis mode, which he talks about with marriage, that's the whole point of creation, is to indicate that you have over here something that didn't exist before. So, me'ein Sefer Bereishit, shepatachabo. The opening of Sefer Bereishit is to achieve this moment, really. But to achieve what it is that Sefer Dvarim speaks of, which is koach ma'aseh v'dibamo, let's say from nachalat goyim, it's all meant to be for the purpose of Eretz Yisrael. And that's al derech ma'ut sofan b'tzilatam. That's the approach that we would think is reasonable, that we have the indications of the end of a process at its beginning, what its tachlit is. So here we're reaching what that tachlit is. And that's the whole point of the interrelationship of the promotion up until this point. All of the things are meant to be achieved only in terms of Eretz Yisrael. Yisrael ein lem shleimut b'chol hazmanim ki'im b'gula achrona she'ein acharei hagalut. And therefore, you would recognize this as being unique, as the siyum of the Torah, not simply as an ongoing part of the saga, but at that which integrates all of the elements of the other Chumashim up until this point, which were only meant to come to fruition in the context of this Chumash, and therefore this Chumash is essentially Bereshit again. So we have Bereshit, it's sort of like the Klal Protokol. We have Bereshit as beginning a vision of the entirety, the various promotions discussing elements of it, and then fruition and integration in terms of Devarim. And therefore we can't put a vav in it. And he compares this idea, he speaks about no vav, he compares this idea to Lulav and Esra. Okay, Kabbalistically that makes a great deal of sense in terms of integration of Esra. In other words, the Lulav, he points out, requires Agat, but that Agat in terms of actual Kesher of the Lulav is only three out of the four medium of Kishurim. And the Esrog remains separate despite the fact that it should be carried at the same time. So you see that there's an element of interconnectedness which nonetheless is so singular that which is integrated, the thing that has all of the elements of the other thing, so it has both the smell and the taste and so on, right? The way the Chazal referred to the other medium. So it may integrate the qualities of the other, but therefore it retains a singular aspect. And, okay, that's not the point. Because there's still an issue to be ma'agid the other meaning. But that's not the point. It would be ma'agid. It would still be good. I mean, what would be wrong? The vav is ma'agid over here. But the idea, I think, relates very much to the nature of Malchus, which is that it's by definition, it's something which emerges and not something which can be directly seen as a result of something. It's part of a mechanical result or a natural evolution. You get to such and such a point, then the natural result is this. Something has to emerge out of qualities that are there before, but is not innate in those qualities. Correct? And therefore, we leave out the vav. It would be the same thing as talking about, we may discuss, let's say, brain structure. And we'll talk about, we'll have different books to discuss brain structure. And we'll get to, at the end of our fourth book, we'll get beyond the chemical and we might start very low on the level, we might start even down at the level of the simple physics of the interrelationship of cellular structure. We'll get a next book, we'll talk about the chemical, and then we'll talk about the biological integration and so on. But when we get to the idea of thinking, then we'll be miyakad a separate idea, because we don't have the direct relationship between the conscious emergence out of the things to be able to trace them back necessarily to things that exist within neurons themselves. So in the Mela, we'll make them separate. This is a metaphor that we're going to use later on to introduce this here, the idea of neurons and brains, the concept of Elah Hadvorim.
The Esrog
goes from
the time it comes to the sense of the beginning being
whole. Yeah, he has a lot of reasons for making the comparison. And it's not all that important to us right now. So the question that we raised was whether, is there an interconnection between these two aspects that separate out Dvarim? In other words, is Dvarim qua Dvarim as Dvarav Shel Moshe in any way related to the idea of Dvarim as the Siyum of Bereshit? That's basically two separate things. So the Dvarim is Dvarim Shel Moshe in the sense that it's a new presentation of the vision of Torah, preserved in the idea of the other name, the other name is Mishneh Torah. You know, so that Mishneh Torah stresses the fact that it's his presentation, to review, rather than being the essence of Torah, to review of Torah. We'll see that it's more than that, but I mean, let's assume that, which is preserved in the English name, the Deuteronomy. It's also the same concept. I'm going to go through it again, the second time. So it's a chazara, so it's a review. So we can't give it a vav because it's taking all of the rest, and it's a second thing to become in a new presentation. So it's even that name basically relates to that idea. But as far as the veracious connection, seems to be that that's a completely different issue. Or can we find something fundamental that brings these two ideas together? I think the next thing that we did was we moved on to the theme of veracious, Sivarian. From what? Yeah, much later. So, the Dvar of Shalmesha, so also, is, strangely enough, not really Mishneh Torah oriented, at least not at the beginning, even though it keeps claiming it's Mishneh Torah oriented, because he keeps saying that he's about to be Be'er at HaTorah Hazot. He says this again and again, except that he never does. You know, he always goes off on a tangent. So, you know, when he starts off talking about it, Oyum Moshe Be'er at HaTorah Hazot Limor, and then he starts, unbelievably, when you think if you're coming to be Mavara Torah, you start with Torah, right? You get to Har Sinai, you say, this is what happened to Har Sinai, now let me be Master to you. Unbelievably, it starts off good. First part of the question. Okay, and here's what it means, right? Instead, unbelievably, the first question he chooses to describe Torah is, and God said to us, get the heck away from this mountain already. You've been here too long. It's unbelievable. Rav Lakam Shevetara said. That is so striking when you've got yourself all prepared to listen to Moshe Rabbeinu's speech. I mean, putting yourself really in the position of someone who's hearing his words as he stands up there and he's about to explain the Torah to you. And when he starts with those words, you got to be in it. What happened to the main part? Sandra Ramban is indeed bothered by this. Like, how is it we don't get to the Aseret HaDvarim? I'm talking about Dvarim of all things. You can't start getting to the Aseret HaDvarim until you go through the whole parsha, half of Eschanan, and finally you decide we're going to talk about the Aseret HaDvarim. And how could that be? I don't know. It seems to be some kind of long introduction. So then why say Yehoyom Moshe Be'er that there are God? And this happens again and again. I'm not going to find anything here.
Isn't that what Rebbe was talking about last week, the human giver, right? The chaotic, right?
Yeah. Well, it's awfully chaotic. I mean, he doesn't have to go out of his way. Right. We're getting there. So that's why we're going to propel some of the issues we did in the eighth, because obviously this introduces the eighth up part. Let's just see where we have the same thing again later on. Probably, but I'm already in the middle, so. So we have Pasuk Yud Ches and Aleph. Yud Ches and Aleph. Thank you. Ah, the Nisamachor is good. That's excellent, right? So Yud Ches, Atzaveh Kamei Sahi, Vanisamachor. Again, we leave Horeb, but I mean, where it's in the base, Aleph, so now, Vanosavah, Seir Yamim Rabin, and again, it's Vayomash and Vayomar Rab Lachem Sovatar, Zepnulachem Saforan, which as soon as we're in a place, we finally have something to say about the place. What Moshe then has to say is, it's time to leave. It's funny, I mean, it's almost, you know, like, well, why not tell us something to happen in the place instead of what happens afterwards? So instead what he does is, he tells us actually about places, rather than telling us that we moved him into places. So, no, it's fine. Thank you. So, opening with this very strange list Barava, Musov, Bin Paran, Bin Tosha, Lavan, Chetz, Chazirot, Zizanele, the attempt to identify place is almost outrageous. We have to know exactly where we are, where we're facing, how long it would take to travel to the front of the West. What's the big deal already? It's the place that's the issue. And the truth is that throughout, when we talk about places, it's almost as if he just wants us to know about the place, and that's because what happened in the place. So as Horeb, okay, now we can leave Horeb. We're at Harsayir, okay, now we can leave Harsayir. Now you got the message. No, frankly, no. That's the message. So what and then, when we talk about the Knesset of Horeb, there's also tremendous stress on, you're here, but you can't go there. That just happens again and again. There we are on the Gvul. Atem Ovrim Gvul HaKeitim B'nei Yisrael. Okay, but it came like me our son. I mean, don't think you're going to have nothing. I mean, maybe draft Kaparaga. This may be, you may be on the Gvul, or you may be standing on the Gvul with Moab. Same issue.
Kaparaga is the ultimate
search for having. Well, or the mocker of having with Avram Avinu, Spumis Alei Tamaris, and so on. None of this is being given to you. So it's again, it's this tantalizing tease here. So there's a tease throughout. In which we mention places, don't tell us anything about the places. And the way Rashi puts it, it's remote. Those first opening places, as Rav Shimon Bar Yochai says, I've read through the whole Torah a few times, never noticed these places. Now all of a sudden he gives me a list of places. What are these places, Bichlal? Because I'm not called a Torah Kula. And there's no such place. What do you mean? Identifying a place doesn't have any significance to it? Well, what's the point? Elam must see that these are remote. So he's going to tell us the Iker Nekud of Dvorim, which the words of Moshe over here, as Chazal put it, Ein Dvorim Ela Dibrei Tochacha. The nature of the word Dvorim somehow is like Dibrei Tochacha, which is also strange. Why is that the nature of Dvorim? The Pashtus, the nature of Dvorim is Ephes Vos. Very, very poor choice of a title, right? Ephes Vos, you know, I have some things to tell you. I mean, even words is not a very good name for a book. I mean, every book is just words. And so then, hold on, let's relax. Instead, what he says names of places to communicate an idea. Tophel and Lavan will be, look at this, you were Tophel and Dvarim Amon, which is Lavan. And Rabbeinu Bash actually goes through seven major chatoyim that are being addressed, and this is connected to the Shiva chatoyim that we find in the Brisa service, Sheva Chatzeseka. However you want to learn it, but so it's a reference to Korach and a reference to Peor and so on. Each one in a very sweet way, without overwhelming us. And that's not quite a good enough explanation of why he's using names of places, because the Moshe Rabbeinu wants to say something roughly, he says something roughly. As Chazal pointed out over here, as the Mefarshei HaMikra points out over here, when he says, Shimuna Amayrim, he's saying Shimuna Amayrim. He talks to Reuven as a Tarbut Anashimcha, a bunch of slobs, no good next to him. I mean, he doesn't mince his words. Over here, he's telling everybody together, he's missing his words all of a sudden. Also strange. Now, the places that are mentioned later on clearly are strongly place-oriented because of the fact that it goes back to the nature of Zechus in place all the way in terms of Lechlecha. In other words, the repetition in which each place that he comes to has a story in it. And that story always has to do with giants. Every place he goes is a story about giants. So if you come to the Amori, you come to this Soyer, you come to Moab, you come to this, it's always a question of whether are these the right giants or the wrong giants. So if you want to talk about the Rephaim or talk about the Anakim, or you come to Gul Moab Atar, why? Now I understand why you think you might get this land. Eretz Rephaim Tech Hashivati. That's because Rifaim were Yashu Balafanim. Oh, you never heard about that? That's because they talk about the Zamzumim. But Zamzumim are actually Rifaim. I mean, the Anakim Ikulahem Zamzumim. And they're Amrado Marav Rom Ke Anakim. Of course, this is all the things that were bothering the Maragun about the nature of Eretz Yisrael. It's a strange people that live there. But actually, this is no different than Kasher. This happened because HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to be Morish them to B'nai Lot. I did the same thing for B'nai Esav, that I'm not giving you any rights to. Kasher Asav B'nai Esav Yoshvim B'Seir. Over there you have the Chori, and Hashem is Mashmi the Chori. Same thing happened with the Avim. Yoshvim B'Chatzirin. Again, the Gemara relates all of these to various types of giants. That's why they're called Avim. Anybody who looks at one of Chazal so obvious. He's seized with a trembling disease. You know, I mean, it's so frightening to look at these things and so on. Chori, because they make the when they walk, they leave such holes in the ground that, you know, so they turn the world into furrows and so on, right? And this keeps on going because Sichon and Og, of course, are the only ones left of the Rifaim. So Rak Em Nisharu Miyetar Rifaim. And you're being given the land of Sichon Og, which is the land of Rifaim. And yet, then that this land, actually, you could have. But it's not the main land. And later on, when he talks about the Rifaim, this is the Eretz Rifaim of Rashidus that I promised you. Now, where was that? There's a brief mention of Behar Rifaim at the end of the list of the Shiva Amamim. But the question is, whether the Schutz Eretz Yisrael goes back to the Mochemes Avram with the Rifaim early on, back in Lech Lecha. And the Shaila is, all of the people that are being given here, Schutz Eretz Rifaim, come from Avram. And indeed it is Eretz Rifaim, but not you. Avram has other children. And the family of Avram consists of other people we're going to have to discuss. How about Lot? Lot was an heir of Avram. He was adopted by Avram, at least. So that was given Libnei Lot Yerusha. This was given Libnei Esav Yerusha. So in other words, we have to see the chaos of the place. And throughout all of the issues of Eretz Yisrael, we are fundamentally, deeply relating to place. So over here, Libnei Lot Natati Ha'emim Lefanim Yeshuva. With Emim. Another Am Gadol V'Avram Kanakim. Rifaim Yechashu Ha'em Kanakim. It's just the Moavim called them Amin. This is like really strange. There's many other elements that I talk on Shabbos that relate the Rifaim specifically to Moshe. Obviously, I mean, the most obvious is the fact that the appearance of the Rifaim comes exactly at the same time that Moshe appears. The Rifaim appear by the marvel and trigger the marvel. Moshe is first appearance, but the marvel, as Gemara points out, where is Moshe Ramurubis in the Torah? In the Yom of Mea Ve'esrim Shana. So clearly Moshe is Benegash B'Shagamu Basar. B'Shagamu Basar appears together with Rifaim. Clearly Moshe and the Rifaim are supposed to be a unit. And until Moshe is able to defeat what is Nishar Miyetar Rifaim, we're unable to enter Eretz Yisrael, which is why Moshe actually thinks that in having defeated Sichon Og, must be with Hutra already the Shua. This goes back to his original Chisoran. In Yuyamav Me'avesim Shana, he's introduced in the Torah as being Moshe, who will be limited to 120 years, which we're told over here, the only reason he's limited to 120 years is because Yam Lo Kidash to Moshe. But in the original Milchama, with the Rifaim, you will recall that it takes place at Ein Mishpat, Hu Kadesh. The reason it takes place in Ein Mishpat, Hu Kadesh, is because Kadesh is Mei Meriva. Mei Meriva is the place where Moshe Rabbeinu essentially loses. And that's why it's called Ein Mishpat, the Mokom She'atid Moshe Lito Mishpato Mimeno. So the whole thing is profoundly related, not only with Eretz Rifaim, but with Moshe himself. Through, specifically, The coming together of Amalek. That's where Amalek shows up for the first time. That's called the Ein Mishpat, which is where Amalek comes the first time. By Rifidim. By Rifidim, you have by Amalek. That begins in Lech Lecha. at the milk bubble with your plane, so that all of the elements are interrelated. And I must tell you, there's one other element that is profoundly related, which is the fact that Dvarim, as the book of Moshe, has a parallel. The parallel of a book that is the words of a human being, as you all recognize immediately, I'm sure, is there's another book besides the five books of Moses that Moshe Rabbeinu wrote as part of the Chumash, but the Gemara refers to it separately. Moshe Katav Sifro, this Sifro shel Bilam. So that Bilam's book, the Matovu, or all of the Dvarim that he said, Asnibias, is incorporated into the Torah by Moshe in the same way that the words of Moshe are incorporated into the Torah. That aspect of Bilam's book, Gemara specifically refers to as Sifra Shel Bilam, that aspect of Bilam's book and Moshe's book is thematic throughout the Chumash. So in other words, we have Vayikra itself beginning with the idea of the olive to distinguish between Bilam's, the small olive is the Vayikar instead of Vayikra is Bilam's Nevius. Vayikra with the olive is Moshe's Nevius. What is the point of beginning Vayikra in that dramatic way? To teach you the difference between Moshe Rabbeinu's Nevius and Bilam's Nevius. Shemos itself revolves around Moshe's insistence of making that difference, that other quote, in which he says, Vameli vadai profi matzasefein b'necha, v'alo b'lechta chaymona, v'nifilino ani v'yamcha. So the Gemara says, that was his bakasha, shalot esher shkina al the of the umesahelon, which is why the parasha Bilam becomes the transition to of the distinction between the Yitzhias Mitzrayim and the Knesset Haaretz. You must get rid of Bilam in order for there to be able to come a point at which Moshe can be Matnis Haaretz, right? Sefer Bamidbar itself is called the Sefer HaGosha because Bilam defines it that way, that it says to Mos Nafshi Mos Yisharim. Bereshit, according to the other Bandyam, is called Bereshit Sefer Yisharim because Bilam called the Yobes Yisharim, and that's the only marker that the Yobes Yisharim is from Bilam, which is absolutely astonishing. They call it Loi Tzuva the Sefer Yosha, now they place the Bilam Sefer Yosha, that is to say, Sefer Bereshit. So that means the entirety is focused around this distinction. Back in the story of the Rafidim, the original Rafidim, in other words, the Kodesh, which is Ein Mishpat, you have exactly the same issue coming up, which is the Amalek and Moshe. And as we pointed out many times before, all of this revolves around, essentially, the point of Keri versus Vayikra, as Chazal said. In other words, the elements of Mabul, Rephaim, Moshe, Amalek and Bilam is a constant battle throughout history in defining the nature of randomness. Isn't that so? Meaning and randomness. So Keri insists that the world being essentially random cannot be meaningful in terms of any of its mechanical elements, because since we find all of the developments of the world in terms of that which is random, then by definition it has to be that way. There's many reasons it has to be that way. But Bilam's taina is that what that means is that the world remains that way. There's no way that, that's Amalek's taina, important. There's no way to assure in a random universe a particular result. That's the nature of randomness. If there were, then it wouldn't be random. So you're left with an impossible contradiction in Amalek's terms and Bilam's terms. And therefore, in the end, Mikra has to win in terms of Olam Hazeh. Emergence is meant to remain separate, which is part of the assertion of Rabbeinu Bacha. If, in fact, the position of the ultimate Yerusha Nachala in Eretz Yisrael is only emergent from the history of Yisrael, you can't link it to the mechanics that occurred up until this point. And whatever is ultimately achieved, but you can't see it as being in the same realm of the mechanics. Now, mainly you can't put the bug in the beginning of the Dvarim. So that it all, and that's basically the idea of the marble. The whole concept of the marble was to reassert randomness in Bria. In other words, if in fact you view yourself, this is the problem of the original Dvarim, the Rephaim that believed, the reason they got there in the first place, was because they insisted that it would be possible to assert a format on the earth, but only from above, not from below. Let's just take the idea of a flame, very simple. What's the simple, even if you take those mythological ideas, those very childish ideas of giants and the way that these are malach and that were meant to come, that wanted to come down and so on. What's the common denominator in all of the midrashim? That the search for a mortal life was motivated by a relationship of that which comes not as an emerged quality of the earth, but as something well defined. A malach doesn't grow out of the earth the way a human does. It doesn't evolve. He is what he is. So there's going to be, if we want to talk about the psychological terms of a malach, so imagine a malach that's provided with physicality. And the psychological terms is, first of all, and by the way, this is a very common theme in movies. You know, about City of Angels. Just that whole idea. Or even meet Joe Black. But the idea that a non-physical entity would be driven mad by the possibilities of physicality is essentially a desire to open the door to a level of reality which is not predefined. By the same token, if it's not being predefined, it involves you in being mortal yourself, in making mistakes yourself, in having choices yourself. So what you think is, the way the Medrash puts it, that the original Malachim Azav Azoil is intimately related with Churban for the simple reason that we see that Yom HaKippurim, which is the tikkun of the Shviras HaMufas, the tikkun of Churban, ends up addressing the Sa'ir La'Azazel, which the Gemara says is to be Mechapon Azav Azoil. So the issues are fundamental of it, both beneath both the Churban and the Shviras HaMufas. The idea over here would be to desire a world which could be well formed by me while allowing me the freedom to well form it. In a sense, it's a dream. Because you have none of the chesrenes of the human predilection to sin in the fact that my being physical is that which has determined my mentality. So you think, yes, nebach. I mean, if the most you can get out of a world is a protoplasmic brain, how much could you possibly expect? And obviously, the protoplasm will be defined by the conditions in which it evolves. So Adam is never going to be able to guarantee you any results. The Malach can find the track on his wall. It's even deeper than that. It's taking your evolution into consideration. It's much deeper than just sleep. And it's saying, I mean, you can only get out of Adama, Ona. And you'll never get the Adama out of Adam. You know, so you may take Adam out of the Adama, but you'll never take the Adama out of Adam. Where did we have this? What was that? You might take. Yeah, but we used it, I think, we used it in terms of Shira. You can take California out of something like that. Whatever. Okay, but it's the same idea. So therefore they tie. And you'll never get around this inability to assure results if you're using Oza. That means that their initial assumptions are assumptions similar to Amalek. The only thing that can possibly help the world is us. So says the Medrash HaKadosh Baruch Hu asks them, and you believe that if you were given physical capabilities, you would be capable of asserting your mentality over the physical. That's correct. That's what we believe. Fine, why don't we try you out? Try them out, and they end up taking Nashim Mikol Asher Bacharos. They're the ones who trigger the marvel. The marvel is now a recreation of this whole randomness in which people believe the world has got to be a place for them. Really, all it takes is a little accidental collision with a meteor somewhere, and watch, let's start all over again. So it basically uncovered a whole world of randomness, which is called Tohom. That's Tohu. So Tohu, in the world of the random, is the Tohom Rava. It's the way that it's used in Kabbalah. And therefore, the marvel now leads you in a world in which you can't trust anything. This is Now, Noah's immediate response, what's the point of reproducing in a world in which it can be wiped out at any moment? And so he begins the process of Brits, correct? The first Brits that we had, the Rainbow Coalition, essentially accepts Adam as another animal and says that the nature of the world is such that it's no longer something that is meant to be supported by Adam. And if Adam doesn't do well, the world doesn't do well. Instead, we make a guarantee with protoplasm itself. There's no mention of Adam in the Bris. There's only a continued reference to protoplasm. So now for the first time, we have a Bris with protoplasm, which is exactly what it is that the Malachim were against. They fail. They make it even worse than it was before. And now we have, it's the Davke Bosser that makes sense over here. So in order for the world to be solved, you need to have meat brains rather than malach brains. Okay. Speaking of Bosser Adam, I need to go out to the desk. You can be right back. Good. Yeah. So we also, actually before we got to this point, we didn't really get to this point, but we'll be getting back to the Mokum issues. We also pointed out another interesting thing that we're using over here this week. Varim always introduces Tisha B'Av, always introduces Shavuot. So the Divrei Tochacha probably also relates to the underlying nature of Tisha B'Av. But what's interesting is that we have all three Eichas, there's three occurrences of Eichas. We have the Eicha of Moshe Rabbeinu, Eicha Salavadi. We have the Eicha, which we talk about in the Haftorah. We always read together with Varim because of this Shabbos Chazon. So that's Eicha Haitzal Zona Kirya Ne'emana. And we have, of course, during the course of the week, we have the three-time reading of Eicha with the three whole olive days that are introduced by Eicha. What's interesting is that much of the Eicha focus is also on place, something that we've discussed earlier in this Eicha series. That instead of describing the loss in terms of human loss, we strangely focus on the place loss, as if the issue is what happened to the city, you know, or how could Darkei Tzion be avilot, or how could it be, how could Yerushalayim, which was a bustling city, become a place in which there's no ba'emo aid. I mean, is that the point, or? Wouldn't we focus as we do in the Holocaust museums? I mean, we're not going to focus on the Warsaw Ghetto. We're going to focus on what happened to the people in the Warsaw Ghetto. We're going to talk about what happened. Look what happened to the Warsaw Ghetto. And so why is the focus specifically in Mokom qua Mokom rather than on the people or on the events? Very similar to what's going on over here. Moshe Rabbeinu takes an entire history and somehow or other wants to be meramis to the whole thing in terms of a place rather than getting into the actualities of the events. You would think that he would want to do just the opposite in a Sefer of Tochacha. He would specifically want to give you the details of events rather than to allow a perception that was just linked to a place, which doesn't do anything to take you out of your real perception. But what's even more disturbing is that the focus on place, if you're looking at what it is he would want you to recognize, you would think that the way the Rabbeinu Bach especially stresses it, you're talking about a saga. The whole idea of a saga is time-oriented. Sorry. Not place, because the nature of saga implies change. It's a story. It's a history. History is something that takes place in time, not in space. So to stress, therefore, the nature of places instead of the events that form history is disturbing. And it's just as disturbing as it is when you read it in Eicha. Because why would I look at the place? We mentioned it's even in terms of the Avelos, the nature of Avelos involves place for some strange reason. Because what we'll always tell an Avel is, Hamoka Yenachim, the place. I mean, like, to refer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu as the place where what I need to be dealing with is what's wrong with time. That's what I don't like. I don't mind place, but it's time that keeps killing me. I mean, places are okay, you know. Right? That is time that's unforgivable. So what are you telling me I'm looking at HaKadosh? And then obviously that is an itself lends its name to the very places that we focus on, the Tzion Yerushalayim, which are called Hamokah. This can't be a coincidence. In other words, Vayar Hamokah Mirakov, we refer to Yerushalayim, refer to the Beis Hamikdash, as the place. So, again, I mean, the place, nonetheless, it's Moed. I mean, it's a, right? The idea over here is Nibli Ba'e Moed, nobody showing up for Yom Tov. And so we're talking about the place aspect, specifically in terms of the way people show up for time. The Olam Moed is a place of time. I mean, there's clearly something here in the Torah that fundamentally relates to two issues. I mean, we're using place somehow as something that is incorporative of time. So here we took a little tangent for a moment to examine the psychological elements of our relationship to the dimensions of time versus space. We pointed out like this, that you have a lot of science fiction stories about time travel. We spoke about the original movie of time travel, H.G. Wells, and that first production, the little room, you know, which the little machine keeps going, guys and stories. He's peddling his time machine, you know, and everything around him is changing. And gets off his time machine, and he's taking a look at everything as it will be, you know. And we pointed out that what everybody seems to overlook is that if you actually did something like that, you would pretty instantly be dead. Because in remaining in the same place and getting onto a time machine, you would find that the Earth has moved on. You're in the middle of outer space without a spacesuit. Right? And that doesn't seem to bother anybody. We're assuming if I'm standing in this room, all I have to do is pedal my little time bicycle. I don't need a rocket ship or a jet plane to try to keep up with the Earth, which meanwhile has moved completely away from where it was, and everything is fine. It's just funny. It's just a funny oversight. Why in fact do we think that? And I pointed out that there's a profound psychological insight in that. Because the truth is that when we interact, we view in a way we view the space as being static, because the way in which we relate to space is by thinking of the coordinates in space rather than speaking about space itself, right? But the real nature of space, when we talk about HaKadosh Baruch Hu as Hamokah, obviously the point is that in providing a choice of coordinates, we are allowing for time. So that really the arena for time is what we refer to as space. It's an obvious thing for us to fall into psychologically, and the physics may also work perfectly well, by the way. Because in real terms, time travel, in actual physical terms, where time travel is possible, has recently been recognized as really possible, but it would involve, basically, alternative universes that link in quantum mechanical terms, in which case the spatial coordinates indeed wouldn't be important. But that may be for the same reason that we're discussing over here. It's reasonable for us to say that the space that I'm in, whatever that space is, should be able to incorporate all the various changes that occur within it. And I would still call that my mokom. If this is linked to some other element of physical space, well, I'll have to make up for that. But the idea of there being a room or a Beis Hamikdash which has a space that could incorporate all of the time changes of Yisrael, in a sense, a place I can speak of as being that which includes the entire saga. But I can't speak of a moment that includes the saga, nor can I speak of time that includes the saga, because I don't have a vision of time as time the way I have a vision of space as space. In time, I'm being forced, this is how I perceive it, I'm being forced through a dimension to which I have absolutely no access. I can't go back, I can't go forward, I don't even know what it would mean to go sideways. So therefore, I don't really know anything about time other than the fact that I seem to be in it. What this is really similar to is a flatland effect when it comes to time. So it's the same way that we could talk about flatlanders as experiencing who exist in one dimension, let's say, or two dimensions. So what would their perception be of a good-sized elephant that lives in three dimensions? It would take an enormous amount of research to try to extrapolate what this thing is. Because it keeps changing on you, depending on where it's crossing the road in front of you. You know, so sometimes it's a toenail, and sometimes it's a line, and so that's very, very strange. Now, it would take thousands of years of research in which you could figure out that there must be a level of reality that's actually a three-manifold rather than a two-manifold, which is an amazing idea, in which there may be actual organisms that exist and that I can only catch little parts of them because I don't really know what it would mean to live in a three-manifold, right? I can try to mathematically describe stuff. Can't really imagine it very well. But I can end up describing the coordinates in the three-dimensional space of something called an elephant. And given enough measurements in two-dimensional space, I may be able to even recreate some vague sense of what the coordinates of an elephant would be in three dimensions. I can never imagine such a thing, but I can describe it mathematically. In our terms, we are flatlanders when it comes to time. Because what happens is we look at my vibrations, which, as the Rabbeinu Bach is pointing out, actually stretches from Bereshis to Kol Yisrael. And we have over here a saga that's incorporated within Maitre Bereshis, which goes from Bereshis through Devarim. What I really have is myself as flatlander bumping into things that are coming from another dimension, which is actually time, and seeing only a little line of it, which is what I experience as the instant of time in which I'm currently living, identifying my life as, right? So that cutting edge moment of time, I need to extrapolate that, well, there must be a past. I mean, maybe there isn't a past, but we're extrapolating, assuming that this is an actual dimension that I'm living through, then I can imagine the totality of this thing as somewhere in which I'm only able to see bits and pieces and then reconstruct. So essentially what I do with the entire history of Yisrael is I reconstruct it based on my interrelationship with the lines that cross my path, right? You'd have to be very silly. Only a child limits life to what's actually in front of them. A child will also do the same thing in space, by the way. It comes a point in a child's development where they recognize the elements of space that allow things to be hidden, let's say. But early on in child's development, this is one of the earliest Piaget experiments, right? So if you take something and you put another thing over it, then there's a point in a child's development which he will think that thing has disappeared. You know, it's clearly simply been covered by something else. But it's no longer there. So that idea that is no longer there, when you get used to the idea of there being a dimension, you recognize that its coordinates can be changed, but it could still be there. Now, it's true that if you only lived in two dimensions, you wouldn't even see it then if it only changed its third-dimensional coordinate, which is a strange thing, because it hasn't really changed vis-a-vis you, except that it's outside of the dimension that you're aware of. And that's exactly what happens to us in terms of time. Nothing has changed. In other words, I give you exactly the same spatial coordinates.
Hold on, no.
So if I ask you, what do you mean? You're describing exactly the spot that I'm sitting in. How could two things be in the same place? Then we'd have to explain to you, sorry, but there's another dimension. You're here now, it's there then. So there's this thing I can give a fourth coordinate. You're not inhabiting the same place. So then, in other words, that essentially takes the aspect of our three-dimensional place and says that what we really think about when we think of three-dimensional space ignoring time is its inclusiveness of all the other elements of that fourth dimension, because we can't figure out where else it fits, right? So if I talk about Amokam Yenachem Eschem, then I'm talking about the place for the universe, which includes all of its change, and which therefore is, in fact, the most deep sense I can get of a saga. When we talk about Yerushalayim and Sion, we're not talking about the Warsaw Ghetto at all. We're not even thinking in the same terms. The Warsaw Ghetto is a place in time. The Mokom, which is Yerushalayim, is time in place. Therefore, that Mokom includes Moed. That would never be said of any of the time experiences that Kalal Yisrael has had. And that essentially relates Dvarim to Maaseh. The idea of Maaseh is that the places themselves are seen as places in time. Over the course of 40 years, these are the stops that were made, which turns a 40-year journey into an integrated whole, integrated through time. But the nature of Dvarim, in terms of Geula and Eretz Yisrael, is to turn the journey through all time of Maaseh Bereishis that goes all the way back to the Koach Maaseh V'Yidla Amo into essentially a single space that incorporates it. These ideas are so not esoteric and not strange that any idiot can relate to Eicha when he reads Megillas Eicha. When he talks about Kiryat Ne'amana, he does not think of Yerushalayim in time at all. He's not thinking of, oh, what a terrible tragedy it was at the Korban. At that time, there was a Korban, and at that time, there were people that were murdered, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, he looks at that. This is an ongoing reality. Korban is a reality. It's called all elements of the tragedy of Yisrael not yet completed. That's what he meant. To him, that's what Yerushalayim means. That's the word Tzion means. It's the incorporation of all of the visions and whatever has been achieved. Whatever particular time I happen to be living in is almost irrelevant. So my own personal position in time, I see as being subsumed by Tzion Yerushalayim, which is why the Mokom that is HaKadosh Baruch Hu is supposed to be Menachem, the personal mourner, the Tocha Beretzion Yerushalayim. That's exactly what it's saying. That Mokom will give you Nechama only when you are yourself incorporated into those who can view true Avelut as the loss of access to the totality of place and not view the time elements as being the tragedy, but rather the place elements as being the tragedy. So it's very much a different Nekuda. If you view the problem of Avelut as indeed being your thrashing against time, then you're simply being childish. Because, as the Rambam points out, things that are the way things are not reasonable to rail against. So, as we pointed out, and I think it's a beautiful, beautiful remnant, and the fact that nobody mourns not existing in the past makes it clear that the nature of mourning, in its fundamental sense, cannot be the mourning of not existing in the future. Because that's one element that people relate to as mortality. There will be a spring that I will not see. Correct. So that idea of there will be a world that I will not have a part of. For heaven's sakes, there have been thousands of worlds that you haven't had a part of. Why don't you sit and worry about them all the time? So that's just a psychological hang-up that you have. It's a prejudice. You got used to the idea of existing, so you'd like to exist. But the question of, does my existence have particular boundaries in time-space? That's a given to you. Obviously it does. I'm not going to mourn not having existed in the 15th century. Why not? The world exists without you. Is that a horrible tragedy? Why don't you mourn that? Because you recognize, well, I wasn't born yet, so why should I? Exactly. And in the next century, you'll be dead. So therefore, you weren't there. So what is there to mourn? That isn't you. The you is only the you in space-time. Why, therefore, are you mourning it? So if you get away from the time element and you come into the nature of space and you say that even though I'm mispowered, I don't view that as conditional to my prayer. I view that as a plus. In other words, I'm really speaking in terms of Kol Yisrael. It's not that I'm saying that each generation must have its own geula. And if not, forget about it. I mean, what do I care if there's a geula in another 50 years? If I won't be around to see it, it doesn't interest me. Right? No, I don't say that. Obviously, we're talking about geula. It would be nice if it would be personally experienced. But I see geula as something that is a spatial event, not a time event. The tragedy is that my being locked into time can remove me from Mokka. That's the problem. So until I'm capable of integrating in myself an identity that's formed by Mokka, and that takes into consideration the totality of Mokka, which includes time itself, that indeed is a tragedy. That's the tragedy of the Shvir Saluchas. That instead of having an integrated reality, we have a reality that is splintered because of the limitations that we have on experiencing time. All of the aspects of Churban and Geula end up needing to deal with that issue.
You're saying Moed is the solution to that because Moed might come back to the same place?
Perhaps. I mean, I didn't deal with that now. It's a different issue which we can get back to. Having given that introduction, I would like to examine the nature of Devarim, per se. So we pointed out that it's awfully strange that in the parsha that introduced, and it's called Devarim, the parsha that introduces the concept of Devarim, we should bump up for the only time against Devarim. But why do we use the Kasher Te'asana HaDevarim in parshas of Devarim? It seems very, very strange that it should be merely coincidence. I mean, why are bees bees? And Devarim, Devarim, and both of them coming from the same basic nukuda. And here, we went back to the issue of the Rifa'im, of Bilam's book, of what it is that Moshe Rabbeinu has to achieve. The nature of Devarim is clearly the main thing that is missing in Moshe Rabbeinu's life. Because he rejects his shlichus based on his being lo ish dvarim anochi. That means that he viewed this as the most fundamental concern that he could possibly have. It can't just mean that he stutters. Let me sound terrible. Other than stuttering, is that the problem? We'll get you an occupational therapist or something. We'll help you out, Moshe dear. Don't worry about it. Or we'll get somebody else to do the talking. I mean, clearly, the dvarim issue means that although he's capable of creating geula in terms of shmos, and shmos is the most fundamental aspect of language, because it's what occurs in Gan Eden, by Yikra Adam Shemot. The first Baruch Hu brings all things to Adam, and he gives them their names. He nonetheless feels that he's not capable of dvarim. And I pointed out that even a child will tell you the difference between shmos and dvarim. The use of the word shmos to give a name to something is extremely primitive. Because what it means is that I simply describe a thing, an element. I can't give you any type of interrelationship between that thing and anything else. To give you a list of words in a dictionary, all of which are nouns, is not going to help very much to give you language. When I get to Devarim, as opposed to Shmos, then I'm telling you that it is possible to convey interrelationships between these things. And that's something entirely different than Shmos is. So when Moshe Rabbeinu says, Lo ish Devarim Anochi, what is missing is the ability to convey information that goes beyond elements, but is the way in which these elements interrelate. Now, this is extremely important, understanding the nature of Devarim here. Because the contrast between Devarim and Devarim is actually a contrast that points something out about the nature of Devarim that differs from Devarim. And surprisingly, Devarim and Devarim are fundamentally interrelated. The way that they're interrelated is in two aspects. One is that it's the structure of the bee that provides for the entire nature of its functionality. In other words, when you have the strongly organized social species, what is astonishing about them is that they are comprised of individuals that cannot function at all, that are so specialized that they have absolutely no use in the real world. The thought of a single bee, the way you could think of a single cat, is nonsensical. There is no such thing as a single bee. A bee is part of an organism, which is the hive. It's not that a hive is a city of bees. A hive is the bee. Take away the hive, you don't have a bee, because a bee is not capable of anything. It can't reproduce. It can't eat. It can't find, it can't do literally anything. It is basically a neuron and a brain. A neuron and a brain can't do anything. It can't think at all. Somehow or other, in the interrelationship between the individual neurons, you can look at them as bees, none of which are capable of thinking, you get exactly the same type of strange relationship that you get in the hive. None of these bees is individually capable of surviving freely or acting like a bee freely. But if it's part of this very complex interrelationship, then the entire thing functions fabulously. And what's marvelous about the bee, which is the dogma that's used in the Parsha, is the way in which the bee not only functions as a group single organism, but shows itself as a group single organism. And that is very rare. And where do we see that? In swarming. And that's the remez that Moshe Rabbeinu uses. All of a sudden, what appear to be a bunch of individuals turn out to be a single animal that's chasing you. And this is very common in cartoons, you know, in all the Disney cartoons, we use bees. They take on these silly shapes and so on. They decide to chase you like this and chase you. Why is that? Because the fact is, you see them as a single thing that's chasing you. You're not escaping the bees, you're escaping the hive. And the darn thing is smart. It knows you're going to come out of the water to get air, and it's waiting to get you. I mean, where in the world does it know what it's doing? How does it? Why is it chasing me? Who's giving the instructions? What's happening over here, right? It's crazy. It's organized by nothing. And this is Shlomo HaMelech points out about the ant. Who's in charge? Who's giving the orders? Queen Bee ain't giving no orders. That was Rabbi's experiment, right? Don't think it's the reproductive queen that's giving orders. The whole darn thing is functioning as if it's a brain. So the nature of Devarim, which is an interrelated between elements that have no function, whole, intelligent organism, is very similar to the nature of the Devarim, in which the human brain is capable of utilizing elements that have no capability themselves of thinking, in order to produce language. The language itself consisting of the interrelationship of ideas that otherwise would have been simple shmos, and now have become devarim. Fascinatingly, almost astonishingly, the difference between the two, and we used, to illustrate this, we used the Rambam and the Mor Nebuchadnezzar, who speaks about the uniqueness of man as a social animal. And it's interesting because you find this in biologists also say this, you know, that what is the human is a social animal. Now, for the Rambam to assert that this unique level, he says this unique level of complexity, he actually is one of the early usages of the word murkab for complexity. Is in other words, the fact that a human being is murkab of so many different elements means that he creates structures that are very complex. And therefore, you see in him things like cities, places, which you normally don't see in animals. They don't build cities. Your immediate question, well, what they do? I mean, they build hives, they build immense cities, and so on. So what does he mean by that uniqueness, which you just explain why hope is so complex. Because hope now is addressing the level of complexity, which is so much greater in humanity. But what is that level of complexity? Essentially, the level of complexity is the fact that the number of possible interactions between neurons in a human brain vastly exceeds the number of particles in the universe. That's an amazing thing. In other words, the rest of the universe is basically simple. Where does the Murkavut come from? Not by the number of elements, but by the number of possible interactions of those elements, right? Which means that the difference between Dvorim and Dvorim, between a human being's brain and between a hive, is a very simple difference in elasticity, or plasticity, or liquidity. In other words, neurons in the brain are not, the interrelationships between them are not hardwired. They're allowed to be liquid. As a matter of fact, even the actual hardwiring of the brain itself is very elastic up until a particular point in life, which becomes hardwired. This kinetic gravity, Esser and Shana, there's two periods, one ending at 13, one ending at 20, in which the brain reorganizes, and it's mamash kinetic. In the Torah, that's connected to the onset of Chiyuvim, and the onset of Chiyuvim in terms of Chiyuv Minashamayim, Bezmin Shomala. And in fact, it's interesting, the recent research points out that the levels that are last organized are levels that are required for taking responsibility, for seeing the implications of what it is that you do. So it takes until about 20 for that to be actually fully formed. And you don't get a chiyuv in Hashemayim until close 20. It was amazing. It's not like the past 2-3 years of research has been coming up. It's just like reaching popular magazines. Time magazine just had a big front cover article on the teenage brain, which they brought a lot of the most recent research. Okay, but anyway, so the relationship between the two is some in terms of the nature of the language that we use. What's amazing about it is that it's endless. You can always say new things, utilizing precisely the same structures, but in different ways. So we have this weird concept called structure, otherwise known as grammar. This grammar is exceedingly complex, and yet has something to do with the way the brain is actually hardwired, as Chomsky, the idiot, has pointed out. Right. And that hardwiring, nonetheless, allows.
He can't be
a
professor. Huh? He can't be
a professor. No, he's an idiot. He's not.
No, he's hardwired for some of it.
Yeah. Okay. Fine. A Rashi certainly is. So the nature, therefore, of speech is a strange interrelationship between the hive organization of the Dvorah, in which the separate bees retain a strange ability to redefine how it is that they're going to interrelate with other bees. So you have all the values of structure without the limitations of structure. You will notice how this stretches back to the refrain. Because that's exactly what they were looking for. They believed that they could take on the structure of a physical reality while retaining the above levels, are normally seen as emergent levels in the human being, of intelligence, and use them to manipulate the physical world in a way that would be completely free of the physical limitations. They turned out to be horrifically wrong, and yet whatever Moshe Rabbeinu's presence was in the Pshigamu Basar, in the nature of humanity, early on in the Chumash, he was unable to combat it. And he dies as well, in the model. In other words, that aspect of humanity, which is the Bishagamu Basar, that identifies the potentiality of Moshe in the Bria, is destroyed in the model. So that the Rephaim and Moshe are the two things that are survive the model, both of which survive, obviously, through Noah, so that you have the Sichon Va'od, as the pasuk is made. They're all that's left of the original Rephaim, which is why he's even given the name Hapalit, because he escapes the model. So in other words, somehow or other, the idea of Sichon and Og remain central to the whole experience of humanity, and the idea that is Moshe remains central. The two ideas again spring up in terms of how Yerusha's art is to be achieved. I'm suggesting that the nature of structure it has to do with the nature of place, and that the nature of the fluidity or the plasticity of that structure has to do with the nature of time. So the question of whether Mokom is incorporative of all of the issues which could be the information ends up being the fundamental problem between Klal Yisrael and Amalek, or in modern terms, between postmodernism and its insistence that there is no particular meaning to any way in which you'll interpret things, because they'll all fit into some possible structure. So between postmodernism and the assertion that if you're asked to talk, it would tell you that certain things are given, which is what happens to Bilam in the end, and you end up discovering that you can't argue with reality. And whatever that means in a more sophisticated level, but that's essentially what the whole story of Bilam is about. Is that at some point, you cannot escape your relationship to the animal. Your relationship to the animal in an attempt to reconstruct your relationship to the chamor, or your relationship to language, which is where language came from back in Gan Eden, in defining the animal, is ultimately going to define your relationship to your own animal nature. In other words, what is the Odeh Tzadik Nefesh Behemto? What is the relationship of your brain to your thoughts? And to think that that is completely liquid is exactly what the problem of Bilam comes to address. It's not simply liquid. The world as it is ends up insisting on certain hardwired realities, which if you attempt to escape, end up destroying you. In the end, there's no way to escape. This is what happens to Bilam. You think that you could separate between the two, live a life of complete carry in terms of Olam Hazeh, isolate events in Olam Hazeh as having one level of meaning, whereas your own consciousness, intelligence, your spirituality has a different level of meaning, and you'll be successful at both, and you find out that you destroy both. That's the story of Bilam in a nutshell. And it all revolves around the talking ass, which every person is to some extent. Because we're all talking asses. Now the question is, at what point we retain the ass nature, at what point we're talking as humans. But somehow or other we need to integrate the chamor aspect of ourselves, which we often find is isolated by the Torah, in order for us to be able to separate them out conceptually. So you have the chamor of Bilam, you have the chamor of Mashiach, you have the chamor of Avram, you have the chamor of Pinchas ben Yair, you have the chamor of Rav Chanina ben Dosa. All of these cases, we look at the chamor as a separate entity and see the level of its relationship to the intelligence that's supposed to be absorbing it, right?
We're subsuming it.
Somehow or other we use that as the dogma of talking material. If you want to talk about a protoplasmic brain, talk about an S. That's the ultimate protoplasmic brain. And when we want to talk about a person who keeps responding like an S, that's what we call him. We call him an S. In other words, if his brain is not human enough to be able to escape its total animality, we refer to him here. You're such an S. That's exactly what we mean. You've remained a chamor. So you may still be able to string words together and talk, but it's on the dard of the speech of a chamor, essentially. By the way, this is an actual, very important, right now, in terms of research, language research and so on, a very, very important machlokas about language and about the understanding of animal languages. In other words, there now exists an entire group of animals that can speak and communicate with each other. They have to use sign language. but they do have a nice vocabulary, nice sign language vocabulary, are able to communicate complex thoughts in sign language. And there are tremendous machlokes about whether this represents true language or whether it still is a language of symbols on the level of shmos that has become psychologically linked to various things that the animal will want without its being able to stand above the language, so to speak, and determine which formation do I see as wanting to form. In other words, a child that gets used to the idea that when he says ice cream, he gets something as ice cream is not the same thing as a child who actually understands the nature of language and uses ice cream in a sentence to be more than getting what it is that he wants from a stimulus response point of view. If a chimp learns that by signing, I want nuts to a trainer, it can get nuts, it may be no different than an infant learning that the sounds ice cream get it something that it wants without really being able to string together ideas that are completely abstracted and use them in a language way. Now, this is a big machlokes. Many experiments are designed specifically, and each time somebody comes up with another Hesber, at which what looks like language may not actually be language, but may be something more like a stimulus response kind of thing. Now, the question is, at what point we believe that we kick in a new definition called language? This is a serious issue already. I'd say it's so serious that it's become part of mamish cutting-edge research. What exactly would we mean by animal language? Mom is dealing with the Chamara Shabila. So what's the animal going to say? What would an animal say if it could talk to you rather than manipulating you? So the manipulation of symbols, obviously animals are capable of tool use. They can use symbol as tools. The fact that an animal can lie is also a functionality of tools. Is I want to get something out of you. So I'll use these words to get it out of you. I can see that as a simple tool, not necessarily as an understanding that you will think this and therefore I could fool you, etc., etc., all of which are higher levels of consciousness. Again, there is some very, very funny, they're very funny, obviously, because everybody's seen animal thinking. It's strange to be funny because it's inappropriateness. There's very funny things that animals do to the people in charge of them, which seems to imply that they certainly have a sense of humor and that they recognize that they can utilize these words in order to gain numerous results. But it's not that goes beyond what we're talking about.
The Shmos Amitam and the Chamorro, and they use language to communicate people out, and they lack the West's rationality.
Massive Yishmael element. I mean, it's so strange to the West that they can't believe it. In other words, they seem to be wired differently. So for the West is incapable of accepting the fact that when an Arab says something, it has zero correlation with reality.
It's only Bashar Mishan.
That's right. Which is the idea of Rekha. And they can't believe it. Since it sounds so much like normal human speech, it has to be part of the way in which what they identify as being normal human relates to reality. It can't just be without any connection to reality. I mean, that it should only be something that manipulates me instead of communication is very difficult to accept. And because of that, they're fooled again and again and again. And they do totally stupid things from the point of view of manipulation. Because they're so committed to believing that words are meant to mean something in terms of communication. That's a very interesting point.
We lost the Shimon dealing with progress and change, because time, the developments of time,
is in the community, the Vaishya Roshan.
They're
also, a fundamentally different relationship to place. The place is only related to is what was, not what it could hold. The idea of progress is inimical. Why would you want progress? That would imply change. And I mean, to a lot of Luddites, it's also, every time you do something, you end up changing things in a way which is damaging. So it would be against progress as well. But anyway, so getting back now to the interrelationship between the concept of place and Dvarim, you begin to see now the formation of an idea that makes much more sense. Let's go one step further. Am I boring you guys? Okay, you can listen after. Ask your questions. I ordered a new MP3 for you. So you will. If you bring it to me, I may be able to fix the old one. But Ruben's supposed to be bringing you a new one. Did you get that, Ruben? Don't forget. JJ, remind Ruben, please. Anyway, and here is the additional point. Part of the fluidity is the way in which we construct the idea of Dvarim being made out of units that can be strung together in different ways. Now, there's two ways to look at that stringing together. One is to view it essentially as an analog. In other words, if I have words, if I write down words, I can imagine that what I'm actually doing is I'm writing down the shapes of my mouth, tongue, air channel, and so on and so forth. So by looking at these letters, I know how to form my mouth. I know where to place my tongue. I know how to release the air in such a way as to create the sounds that these words have come to mean. And that's what language consists of. Basically, analogs to changes in my mouth. And there are ways, I mean, if you're doing phonetics, there are ways to actually take all languages and simply use the symbols that have come to mean in the study of phonetics, have come to mean the way in which your mouth forms. And then we could express all languages through one complex alphabet in which somebody reading them would know the way in which they're supposed to be expressed. Am I correct so far, Bob? What do you do about music, Helen? I know that's only stress and pitch. How about Mandarin? Did you do that?
Mandarin?
Mandarin. Because we pointed out that language can exist also in many dimensions, depending how many coordinates you need to interpret the language. It's not only enough to move your body in a particular way. You might have to also change the pitch, the tone, and so on. But there are languages that make complex use of the interrelationship of tones. They introduce a new thing called music, which are part of the Taimiya Mikra, which completely changes the meaning by showing different levels of interrelationship that wouldn't show up just in the letters themselves. You know, obviously, in Hebrew, the vowelization that occurred. I mean, the Gemara talks about the Sun Sex, all about the different levels, you know, of Mikra, of Misora, of Tainim, and how those are all central into understanding what a Pasuk really means, and so on. So you have Pisuk, Tainim, and so on. So that would be analog. The question is, at what point we recognize that language actually changes the way in which a thought is formed. Because we often, very often, understand things only because we said them, correct? That is to say that the language incorporates more in it than the planning of the usage of the language could plan for. So as we say something, we're surprised by what we said, because it's megala things that we hadn't realized in our original planning on saying it. This is very, very common in punning. Now, in punning, the person who puns almost never knows that he was punning when he puns. He only puns liakra maitan and realizes that he puns, which is why we denigrate puns, because we don't believe the person really thought it out that well. It's too much of a thing that is megala truth to him, and he's trying not to make it into something that he works out. But the humor of it, on the deepest level, is the fact that it somehow integrates inappropriately different levels of meaning. Why, in fact, would this be a pun? But this across the board. When we explain something, we come to understand it. It's wrong to say, if you can't explain it, you don't understand it. It's much more than that. It's the explanation itself that creates the understanding, not that simply gives you the understanding. So that means it becomes a point in language in which the language becomes formative of the thought to the same extent that the thought becomes formative to the language. Now that's a very unusual quality. The truth is that in Kabbalistic terms, language is not an analog. It's not that we have particular things that are wired together or we could string together in a way that has an analog to what we want to achieve. It's that the nature of language is such that it is the information out of which things are constructed. So we reach a level of usage of language, of ksiva, of osios, in which we actually, instead of looking at it primitively, as it initially evolves as an analog, so we could start off with a dollar being a delet, being a door. And then
it's
it can...
Pictograph. Steinbeck
said that. Yeah, as a pictograph. We can then go on to a picture representing the way in which we say the word of the picture, so the first letter of that word becomes the meaning of the pictograph, and now it's an analog to movement of your tongue and lips and palate and so on and so forth. We can go beyond that to the nature of information, in almost a digital sense. I don't care, really. In other words, if I'm using this information digitally, I don't care what the analog is. I couldn't care less about how it's pronounced. What I'm interested in is simply coding of information. It makes no difference to me whether it even has any analog to something that's in the world. I take it outside of its worldly connections, of its physical connection, and I digitalize it. You know, to try to listen to a computer is communicating through a modem. I mean, I don't expect that it should make sense to me, the tones of the... I recognize that all that it is. It's just a way in which we can digitalize information and separate one unit of information from the other. So I'll use a string of ones and zeros. And in primitive modems, I'll use songs. You know, it's used as a... That's just a primitive analog to a digital reality that I turned into analog in order to be able to use old-fashioned phone lines that are better for analog than digital information. Obviously, it's a very sad way to have to communicate, as anybody who has a better quality modem knows. But you can do that, too. I don't get caught up in the... even in the analogous aspect of the information there, because I say, yes, I'm just using the analog to communicate digital information, right? The end result is, the ultimate result, is that there exists, very strangely, through simple, what were originally analogs to particular things, analogs to emotions, analogs to outbursts, in which I was able to gain mommy's attention by saying ma, which is an easy thing for a child to say, to cry. Now I develop a word called ma. Now the sound of the word no longer means anything. Not only that, the concept of ma is no longer a mother with breasts. The concept of ma is now yesh ein lamikra. How do I relate to the fundamental nature of reality from where I come? Same thing happens to Av. It may start off as a simple way for an infant to gain the attention of the hunting member of the group, right? It then becomes a way in which one refers to father. But then father itself becomes the word for paradigm, which is parent, and so on and so forth. Now I use it in a completely you know, Saddam Hussein has his mother of all battles. We have a fatherland. Certainly we're not talking about sperm and egg. We're talking about ideas. So things that eventually become completely conceptualized seem to lose their relationship to the analogs that brought them into being in the first place. And what happens is that the idea of the simple nature of language, and by the way, this is undoubtedly kosher to the change between Ksav Ashuri from Ksav Ivri. In other words, the nature of the development of Yisrael into a Torah Sheba'al Peh was kosher to the development of writing from a writing that was strongly pictographic, which an ayin was an ayin. You draw an eye and that becomes now an eye, and you have very strong elements of the pictograph in every oath, into something that is much more conceptual and has in it all types of little elements, stressing the interrelationship between more basic elements. So you construct new ideas out of combinations of the old ideas, and your olive becomes two above and two yuds and things like that. That's really wild. It's a very powerful step forward in recognizing that writing is more than just analogs. Until you finally get to the Kabbalistic usage of languages and the Shemes Hashem and the power of, I mean, or in shamanic societies of the power of words to create new realities and so on. We start thinking about words as no longer being connected necessarily with the way in which they originally emerged. So now we're looking at them from the point of view of the Rifa'im. Instead of looking at words as being things that emerge out of the protoplasmic experience, let's take them, reduce them to pure ideas, take even the osios and break them up into very fundamental units of information, and put them together. Now, this is a completely different way of looking at the nature of information, far more open to Bilam's approach than what we thought was Moshe's approach. Because essentially, it's very, very postmodern. What it's saying is you could string together a list of ideas, and to the person who created those ideas, it would have one meaning. But your interpretation of those ideas could be completely different than what it is that was an intent in putting it in. Because the information content is much, much broader than that person who was limited, particularly in time, could possibly have inserted into it. We do the same thing. We do the same thing when we talk about Shira, when we talk about poetry. In other words, we can have tons of analysis of Shakespeare without anybody necessarily believing that Shakespeare meant any of it. Because it's irrelevant whether Shakespeare meant any of it. It's what he said. And in what he said, he will be able to discover Chidushin. And exactly the same way in what you say, you will be able to discover Chidushin. And everybody has experienced this and knows that while it might have been innate in what he said, he didn't even understand it as he said it. It may have taken him many, many years to figure out what he said himself. Yeah. Please.
T.S. Eliot actually defined poetry as having all the great writers in one room simultaneously. And anything that's ever written that's actually good, that literature, will immediately influence everything that we learn. Mm-hmm. So that all poetry exists on a simultaneous way and is rewritten and influenced on a new room.
So he talks about place.
Yes.
Our concept of place. In other words, the temple of poetry is his base on image. Because it would include all poetry, and then the child is the particular events that come in this interaction with time and your mind and so on, that are the poet's experience.
It's more than that, he says, that the entire, if anything good is written, the entire system has been redefined.
But that's true in any system.
Right.
So that's fine. In other words, we do the same thing with Torah. We can come up with a chiddush, or the same thing in science. Come up with a chiddush. There's no way to support that chiddush unless the entire structure can support it. So one change in the nature of science forces us to redo the whole thing. We can no longer accept the things that we accepted up until this point because it needs to be now redefined. This very much connects to the Esa idea that we spoke about on Shabbos. So,
and the Bekiva can deal with Chavi, and the Bekiva can deal with S.
And the Osir. So, the idea here, therefore, becomes that in utilizing the place, by the way, Barnea points it out, it's the Navajo, right? That's the Apache. The Apache, American Indians, utilize place as very much as Moshe Rabbeinu does. In other words, the word for a particular place is meant to incorporate all of the feelings, ideas, experiences, and history that are in that place. And we do this in English also, but not all that often. I mean, remember, the Alamo does not mean a little building. It's to remember an entire war and Custer and mistakes and solutions and so on and so forth. I mean, it becomes a very effective, in their terms, I mean, it's very limited, obviously, and only applies during its time, but it's very much the idea of Esa, remember Yerushalayim. In Loris Karek, I mean, that's what they would be saying basically about the Alamo. But for a language to really focus around place and to use place names, you know, that's already something that you find much more that's done in Torah, in which all of it, Mitzrayim is not Mitzrayim. Exactly, it's yes, Mitzrayim is not a historical event. It's an ongoing reality that defines your mentality in terms of the issues, and that it means a whole big thing. If I'll sit down one night a year and discuss it, it'll take us all night, and we'll still only scratch the surface, obviously. People will have to come in and remind us it's time for Kriya Shema, and we'll wait until next year. But that's what we mean when we talk about Mitzrayim. And we say those simple words, Zegleit Yis Mitzrayim. We mean the Brisbane Absorim, we mean the whole thing of Arami Yovidavi, we mean Masa Begnus Besayim Beshevach, the Sag of Yisrael, the nature of human freedom, what ingredients go into human freedom, Avram Avinu's interrelationship with Nimrod as a freedom fighter, the nature of religion as being anti-freedom, it's all of these ideas, right? That's what Zegleit Yis Mitzrayim means. It boils down to the nature of everything. The ultimate expression of that idea is Tzion Yerushalayim. Everybody relates to it in that way because they know they're not mourning over a Tzion that was or a Tzion that will be, but rather the Tzion that does not seem to be, that should be but isn't. That's the problem.
So, addressing, okay, now let's
start
seeing this here. We've gone through the process, now we're
going to
appreciate it.
Yeah, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi has a very strong sense of it. I mean, that's why he's so powerful, right? When he talks to Tzion, and you sense the personality, you know, the Tzion Halot Shalvi, and the sense of one's personal connection to this, because of everything that it is, not a silly historiographic idea or a silly archaeological idea of I walk in the paths of Abraham, you know what they try to get tourists to feel. They say, yeah, maybe yes, maybe not. I mean, you know, something thousands. It's interesting. It's fascinating, but it's certainly not me. That's not what we're talking about over here. We're talking about the identification of oneself within that T.S. Eliot room that she's describing, or the thing that people experience when they're learning Gemara, you know, the nature of being part of the over time
dialectic.
It's an over time dialectic. In other words, I understand that all of the people that ever discussed anything in the Gemara are specifically talked about in the Gemara, but they're talking to each other. You know, Rabbi Akiva, this is what he would say. You know, so in other words, I sit at a place which incorporates all times, all learners, including myself. That's very much that vision of T.S. Eliot, is basically learning Gemara. So that in the interrelationship with it, I understand that part of the development of the information includes the information as I see it now. And this was exactly Moshe Rabbeinu's problem, in which he says, Takarish Baruch Hu Book. But the Akiva understands it much better than I do. So I don't understand why I should be the marker of giving Torah. And this ties in very much with his idea of lo ish dvarim anochi. I don't see myself as being somebody who maintains dvarim well, right? And the answer, essentially, is is that Moshe Rabbeinu's advantage is the fact that he doesn't understand Rabbi Akiva. In other words, the disadvantage, ultimately, of understanding Rabbi Akiva is what happens to Rabbi Akiva's Talmidim. If you understand him, you can also get wrapped up in the particularism of his definitions, in which he goes back, as Barnea pointed out, to even describe the more sophisticated elements of Kiva per se as having meaning on some abstract level. That idea is wonderful, but it's also very destructive. So the Moshe Rabbeinu's, the power of Moshe Rabbeinu, is that he would be able to go into Rabbi Akiva Shir and find it full of chidushim, which means that his vision of the interrelationship of the Dvarim was liquid and fluid all the way to the beginning. And this is essentially his answer to Bilam all along. Bilam cannot retain anything of the fluid unless he denies the structure. So for him it has to be carried, unstructured, structured, ad hoc, as you desire. And that's his rega. The more you succeed in splitting up time into little photographs, the faster the shutter clicks, the better off you are, because the less mistake you're going to make of attempting to understand the room, so to speak, the place where this is coming from.
And choosing physical places that only see slices.
Yeah, sure.
The reader's attack on
completely.
Yes. The sword may think that there's a system of language in which each and every word relates to something else, and that's what defines me, even though
internally constructed.
Yes. It says that even though you could say that me is given an arbitrary space, but because it relates to everything else in the system,
right,
it has one word. It has one meaning.
Right. And he denies even that. In order to be able to.
There's no system, and as soon as you bring up one word, you bring up all the meanings that it's not.
Sort
of the opposite.
Right.
By defining what it's not, you define what it is.
Right. Yeah, it's right. It's exactly this point. Well, I mean, we always talked about that very often.
But it's interesting.
He's the ultimate villain.
But it's exactly at that point
in the
system that he argues that it's
important. Right, yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. To actually dismiss it. Well, it's because Bilam is, in the end, is going to be an attack on language. Which is why what we say is he's stealing our language. That's why we kill him with a cheres, that he stole our language, right? That the keres of Yisrael is the pez, so therefore we'll steal his sword. Which is a beautiful bita keneged mida. In other words, you're the guy who can't even kill a chamor without a sword, and claims to be able to use language, you know. Well, we'll just go down to your level, you know. Let's see if we cut out your heart, whether you keep on talking. This is the presence of Bilam within my total and absolute randomness, all possible interconnections at all times, which lead one to be unable to learn anything because you have to do everything in everything and anything at one time. As long as it has some filter on it, it's endlessly useful. The filter breaks, my gosh.
My
he tries. And sometimes it gets clogged. That's a beautiful example. And that's why it's called Barnea. So seriously, it's the child of movement. It's constant movement. Sing my glory. Which is connected to muscles. So here essentially we have the two elements, which are the set of Dvarim now being an emergent reflection of Bereshis, being the only way in which Bereshis ends up being capable of addressing a particular physical reality because it comes from that space. The Rabbeinu Bakia himself identifies back in Bereshis the nature of Chumash Dvarim, built upon the words Vayikra Elohim Maor, he said the Vayikra Elohim Maor is connected Mishnah Torah. And why is that? Why isn't Vayikra connected Vayikra? Because that's assigning meaning. Because the idea of calling Vayikra Elohim Maor is to apply it. I call it, because that's where we understand it. Not that I give it the name Or. But Vayikra Elohim Laor and was applied it to Yom. Not Vayikra Elohim Laor Yom to limit it to be Yom, but rather was Vayikra Elohim Laor and to apply it to the Yom. The level of insight of this membership is absolutely astonishing. Because if you read the nature of the Pasuk as Vayikra Elohim Laor Yom, so it means that we will limit the nature of light by giving it a local definition of day. Now that's crazy, because light is an abstraction. And indeed, the or, the initial or, needs to be gone as it's so abstract, and includes all possible information that would be or, because that's what or means. So if you would say that the meaning of Vayikra Elohim Laor is the nature of Mishnah Torah, then what you'd be saying is that Moshe Rabbeinu is insisting that his particular way of looking at Torah is the correct way of looking at Torah. Therefore, I now want to tell you how it is you should have looked at Torah and what you did wrong. But if, on the other hand, the nature of Moshe Rabbeinu's Torah is Vayikra Elohim Laor Yom, meaning, let us apply to this particular circumstance the nature of information that comes from a room that includes all possible applications. Now, I want you to see how it is that I go about doing such an application. Because that will spell the difference between something that remains abstracted to something that has application. That's a tremendous difference. And becomes now the basis of Mishnah Torah in the Medrash. But what's more, it's linked to another meaning in the word Dvarim. Because the idea of Dvarim also is to insist on a particular structure, which is Daber, Yadber Amin Tachtenu, or Dabar Echad Ledor, or Adabre Rapsheshes Lid. In other words, if I want someone to walk in a particular direction, I'm being Adabre. If I want to overcome the impact of the Umayyads and force them to be tributaries, I'm Yadber Amin. If I lead, then I'm a Dabar. And in English terms, the spokesman. So the spokesman for the Irish people and so on, before they gain a Malchus, right? Okay. So, or as Asimov's term, first speaker, in the sense of prime minister. Or in the Gemara's terms, and with the Romans giving the right of speaking to Rosh Hamadabrin. Now, Rosh Hamadabrin is a level of leadership, right? And that's really the prime minister was the first to speak, essentially. He's the first among equals, especially with the way he's supposed to look at the prime minister. That concept of Dabar means that the organization that I have has a specific application as opposed to just words. So it's not only the organization of the Shemas, it's the application of the Shemas. In the name of the Rambam says, if I take the Torah Shebichtav and I give you a concrete application and structure, I am now talking about something new. So new that I will give this the name of my book. I will call it Mishnah Torah. So what we came to understand is that Mishnah represents this strange combination of Dibur as that which is able to be applied. Because Mishnah, first of all, the central idea of Mishnah is that it represents an organized but fluid way of correlating information, which does not have a similar, I don't know of any word in another language that includes this idea. The nature of Mishnah is essentially Seder. So that Rebbe goes out to be Misader Mishnah, but essentially requires him to make sure that in his Seder, he retains 13 different levels of interpretation. Remember those stories in the Gemara, one of which he forgets. And there was the Kovach that reminds him because he had overheard it. So in other words, the Mishnah is so beautifully organized that we call it Sidrei Mishnah, that's its point, is that it's Sidarim, which is the opposite of Bilam. He insists on organization. And yet it's organized in a way that retains the fluid interrelationship that Zvarim itself does. This is so devastating to modern people that they're totally lost by Gemaras because of it. In other words, when you learn Arba Oves disease, and then you get to a Gemara and you can't believe that Mava, what do you think of Mava meaning Adam, because it says into Bayou, but what the hell are you talking about? That seems outrageous, that kind of crazy thing to me. And if you want to tell us something, why don't you just say so? To start telling you about it, I don't even know if you're talking about 1632, and they supposed to be included in the four. Are we including people, or are we saying there's only Mamono? Something so simple you can't tell me? It's outrageous, because that's the whole point of the Mishnah. In order to be able to allow you to recognize that the Av, in terms of a paradigm, is so incredibly abstract that you need to choose the one word that no one will be able to figure out what it means. Because it talks about the fundamental interrelationship between a human being's capability of doing what? Of reorganizing the way he thinks, which is intavayu vayu, shubu esayu, which relates directly to kichui mochem dvarim, because that's the nature of tshuva. So that Adam now becomes Adam because he's capable of tshuva. But the commas were after that. You think this is all crazy? But that's exactly the point. That the nature of information structured on this level even has to include the recognition of Adam being dangerous because of the fluid nature of his mind. His way of utilizing Dvarim is reflected in this Mishnah. And its attainment in the end in being able to restructure the way he's thinking with the Dvarim that lead him to Teshuvah, which is the only response to Eicha. In other words, if there's something fundamentally wrong, which is the Eicha issue, then it can only be addressed fundamentally, which insists on a restructuring that allows you to take Dvarim, to Chui Makam Dvarim, and use it to be Shuvah al Hashem. Because to whatever extent my world is an artificial reality, illusory, because I've constructed it out of my words. The only way of deconstructing it is to go back, deconstruct the words that I use, and reconstruct them by being kachuimok and devorim, and now being shoved with them, which requires a complete rebuilding of my reality. You cannot do teshuvah without that level of reconstruction. You cannot do teshuva. We pointed out that this is the room that we're talking about. The room is such that the level of the interconnection, of the assumptions that are made within this marker, if I relate to it through my own specific moment in time, this is the wonderful conversation that we had about fear, which I think is so beautiful. Anybody who ever discovered something was a heretic. Had to be a heretic, right? Because he had to doubt all that he was taught. So if Einstein is to discover relativity, he has to be absolutely heretical in terms of Newton. He has to refuse to accept certain givens that everyone has accepted as givens for hundreds of years. For Newton to be Newton, he has to be willing to be a heretic against things that have been accepted for 1,000 years or more. In other words, the more you become capable of new ways of seeing the information everybody's always had, the words that everybody's always had, but being willing to see them as they might mean rather than as your assumptions as to what they mean, you need to attack the previous level of assumptions. There's always avelos that's involved in that. Every tshuva is achieved through the Avelos, Ech Naflu Niborim, essentially. Gosh, we always thought that Aristotle had it all. Now it turns out he's really an idiot. That's very disturbing. and so on and so forth. I mean, what we pointed out on Shabbos was that if somebody would have come with some total of changes at any one point, they wouldn't even have bothered burning him at the stake if he was thinking about yesterday, I mean 2 to 3 days ago. Because he's so mad that he's obviously out of his mind. You know, it's one thing at one point to doubt one element of the structure. I don't believe in the quintessential nature of the sun. I see spots on it. Nobody else agrees to look at the spots because it's too threatening. And if you see spots, I have very good explanations for the way that human vision is affected by bright lights and causes spotting. And I'll even prove it to you. If you look at the sun, you'll see spots after you look at the sun. So certainly it's not something that has to do with the sun. There you go. So stop being such a fool and thinking that the sun is what has the spots. God, never. So it's one thing to see spots. It's another thing to start talking about not only spots, but to come up with an idea that the sun is made out of nothing but some gas, that is totally mad. And that not only that, but that the whole system is just a bunch of rocks. And it just happens to be that you're on a rock that's attracted by some invisible force. I mean, this guy's mamish out of his cotton picking knocker. And then we go ahead and we discover that not only that, he thinks that all of the different forms of life are related to each other, and that apes have something to do with humans instead of being God's way of thinking, us laugh at ourselves, and so on and so forth. So that he's not to die to burn at the stake because he's too mad, right? You shoot him, take him out of his misery, put him into an insane asylum. See, that level of the fluid nature of information is the only way in which it's possible to address Eicha in the ultimate sense, which is why Moshe Rabbeinu is insisting, look, forget about your personal experiences, okay? Let's talk about that place. What do you think that place could mean over the entirety of human history? There's something that you did and you experienced. It's only part of the moment in which you experienced it. But that's not the way to see it. You have to see it as part of a world that is. The fact that you're stuck in it and can't get a view of that other dimension is no excuse to be silly enough to experience reality only in terms of the dimensions that you're in. You know enough to see that there's something else that you have to now extrapolate and define. The better you are at extrapolating and defining it, the more real your life will be within the dimensions that you're limited to. And the moments of space-time within which you exist, you may not appreciate it fully. Of course, after all, you're limited. Your metaphors are limited. But your responsiveness will be unlimited. To whatever extent you can respond, whatever new piece of information you can get will make a difference. Which means that you will then begin to exist in four dimensions instead of three. You take on an entirely different reality when you respond in that level. And because of that, you're no longer closed off and locked into experiences that make it impossible for you to fight the Rephaim. To fight the Rephaim, you have to see the earth from the outside, not from the inside. You have to be able to extrapolate what information could mean, not what it does mean to you. You have to be open to all the possible interpretations of Bilam, while insisting that there is, in fact, an organization, which is the Seder HaMishnah, something that's referred to here in the Midbar. We point out that Arbaim Shana is men, Shana, Mishnah. The changeability of Mishnah is built into the word Shana. It's the change. In the same way that the changeability of time is built into the word of time, which is Shana. And that's, I mean, the insight of the Rambam in calling this book Mishnah Torah is mamish, it's wild. Lachain Karafis, yeah, okay, it's a nice name, I picked it out of the document. Sort of matches, it's absolutely amazing, in which, by not giving you the alternatives, by showing you a structure which things can match, you become aware of the different ways that structure could be achieved. I'm not here to give you a particular description. I'm here to give you a balanced description. You want to get the particular description? Go read the Gemara. And the Gemara is going to have Sobas, Zelmar Ko, Mazel Marco, and how it is that we can reach a balance between them and so on. That's not what I'm here for. I'm here to give you the Seder. I'm here to show you a structure that makes sense. It's up to you now to see from, just as Moshe Rabbeinu said, I can't give you all the answers. You're going to need Rabbi Akiva. As a matter of fact, it bothers me still that I can't even get to the front row and Rabbi Akiva's here. Yeah, that bothers me. How come I'm all the way back in the room and other people understand him better than I do? So he needs to hear something to make him feel a little better. But the thing that that goes hand in hand with is the fact of Rabbi Akiva's death. In other words, when he added, there's no question, the two are interrelated, because he says it himself. He says, God, you showed me this man. Now show me his great sakhar. And God shows him the meat of Rabbi Akiva being weighed out in a butcher shop. Right? I mean, what is that? Just a game? Of course it's not a game. It's saying that the nature of openness to completely chaotic elements forces an openness, or can be forced by an openness, only to absolute korban. Because that's what korban means, the breaking down of all of your structures. The threatening all of your cherished notions. So that in the end, humanity that arrives even in a simple scientific description of its own position in the universe has lost every one of its cherished notions. One by one in the most painful way. So that if we were suddenly confronted by this at one moment, we all would have gone mad. To have discovered all at one moment, without having had any opportunity to grow into it, that we are not the middle of the universe. We're not even the center of our own solar system. That we're surrounded by giant rocks aimed at us to keep missing us by a couple of degrees. And so on and so forth. That there isn't even any material here, because it's just all interactions between certain forces. So you start wearing snowshoes like that physicist that stop falling in between the spaces between the atoms, right? I mean, your mind is completely boggled by it. It doesn't make any sense. All you could say is, I give up. It's not meant to be understood. It's not meant to be experienced. Forget about it. And you curl up and that's all. You curl up and shrivel. You have to have some way of dealing with reality. And there's no question that a primitive human being meeting someone like us would be completely shattered. Because the level of forces and the level of understanding that is given to every single child would be so overwhelming, so frightening. I mean, imagine somebody even from 200 years ago meeting a modern child. How could you possibly know all of this? You're only 8 years old. Are you a midget? How could you be doing this? What are those things that you're handling? Oh, how could you be stronger than the Roman Empire? And so on and so forth. It doesn't, none of it makes sense. It would be like us meeting a race of magicians. We're fighting. Giants, right? And which every single person, I mean, sure, he could actually be a giant. You put him in his little toy, you know, which makes him four times his size and has little servo mechanisms. You know, meet the 8-year-old looks down and says, hello, human. Ah! You really have met her opponent. Because in a sense, you have. He's just shattering all of the things that you take for granted that couldn't possibly exist. And my father's a false beautiful example. It's the Rambam is seeking to express the idea of imagination, utilizing elements that you know, but putting them together in ways that are impossible. His expression of how imagination could deal with the impossible is, look, you can see a ship and you can see a bird. So you can imagine a flying ship, but of course such a thing could never be. Isn't that great? It doesn't matter who you are. The limitations are obvious. A ship can't fly. Every time I get into an airplane, I keep thinking about how I love to take the Rambam on this trip. Every single time. It's such an amazing thing. Well, these are things that are like totally beyond what anyone but a refined could do. Sure, with magic and shamas and whatever, I don't know. But certainly not part of our normal life. But it is. anyway, I think that covers the main ideas. Ah, yes, thank you very much. This idea of Mokum, by the way, is so clear in Tanakh that we even expect that events are meant to be linked to a place. That what Yosef Hashem Le'ira'oz takes its cue from Achar Shemira Le'Shmuel B'Shilom. In other words, Shem becomes a Mokum that's Miyuah L'Puranut. The idea of containing the possible future events within a place is taken for granted. And that's mamish what we're talking about. Yerushalayim is meant to include a Yerushalayim that is formerly the Chorov, and formerly, as the Medrash puts it, Her Olo Beis HaMikdash, in its entire process of being a Beis HaMikdash. That's what it means to be a Beis HaMikdash. It's the inclusion of that entire process.
Let me also talk about, I applying with the talk about Shmagor and places. The main place you can check what the events are.
No, okay. Certainly makes sense.
So Chaim Simus made a mistake. He goes first. And it's in a story of someone who's the Kamsa Bar Kamsa, which is a slightly different language. Because he was first speaker, he learned everything. Because he was too much of an honor, which is a Rosh Chaim.
I don't know what she's talking about, but I'm sure it's beautiful.
Is that bad?
I don't know. I don't know what this is.
She was in the last speaker, the first speaker.
I don't know.
It led to Horban.
What's that?
It led to Horban, not recognizing how much was in the last.
Yeah. I don't hear it at all. Anybody need to speak? Yeah. It sounds. But it needs to be recorded. No, I forgot about that. Is it too bad to bring in, or does it stand without it?
It stands without
it,
but
it works.
Have you mentioned Tophosa? Okay, I did discuss that the nature of Tophosa itself includes proof, as it does in the English as well. Reproof is another way of saying rebuke, which is Tophosa. But it also includes presence in terms of Nocheach, Nochechut. And that's one of the central ideas of it. Presence is essentially Mokum. What it is that Moshe Rabbeinu achieves over here in his Tophosa is to provide an actual presence for an idea, which is much different than, we use that even in law by these presence. There is a concept of presence meaning an argument. Because when I present, it's not just that I make it visible to you. It becomes itself an argument. If something is merely theoretical or abstract, then the listener can interpret it any way he wants. But when we have nochechut in terms of tofasa, the other way of saying it is, I'm going to be mochiach you al panev. Right, so we have an idea. Say it to my face. What does that mean? Because we require you to have more guts to say it to my face, or because in my presence you recognize that it's not true. This is not, it's an interpretation of reality, but you know that it isn't the one that was experienced. So the actual presence makes it real in a new way. Okay? I mean, I use this in the framework test every day. I use this in the sense of providing for authenticity. The nature of authenticity is actually, I believe, the nature of presence. Because, let's say, it can't be just information. Because nobody is going to pay 100 times the amount for a disc of the Beatles than they would pay for the same information on a CD of the Beatles, where the CD may present the information even better than the original disc. Right? So what is it that they're looking for? It can't be that the information is better. So that the abstracted information clearly is not what they're talking about. Same thing is true of a painting. It's taken 500 years for everybody to discover that this is actually a Talmud of Rembrandt. It isn't a real Rembrandt. Whoops, there goes $300,000 or $300 million, you know. I mean, nobody knew, so who cares? Can't we just pretend? I mean, it's obviously a good painting because everybody thought it was Rembrandt. So what is added now by the fact that you realize it was a Talmud of Rembrandt? It's not Rembrandt, because it doesn't have the presence in the information. It may have the information, but it's not information per se that I appreciate. The Torah without Moshe belongs to the Rafidim, belongs to the Rafidim, basically. It's information. It can be anything. It's Mishnah Torah that needs to be said by Moshe that provides it with a face, that provides it with a heart, that provides it with a presence, with an undeniability, which is the rebuke aspect, the reproof aspect. Yes, Bilam can say, but God didn't really mean that. But once you have a Mishnah Torah, there's always that ass in the background, which is the feelings of, so what's the reality, which reflects the other aspect of Devarim, which leads us to compunctions. We have compunctions about what we say. You know what compunction comes from? Stinging, which is a stinging rebuke that's given by bees. There you go. Okay. Couldn't resist that one. But it's interesting. It's puncture, basically, right? So the bar has to be able to puncture you by its insistence on its reality. Don't talk about it. Feel it. Hold on.
No.
I'll record it.
In the Din of Second Mamre, Rambam first defines what the Beis Din is and what Torah is.
Right.
He says that the Beis Din is Ikar Torah Shabbat Pavia and Mudi Haram, and so the Mishnah, the Cholamayim, and the Moshe Rehu Tarasa, because now you have an authentic connection. Elsewhere he says that the Rosh of the Beis Din is the Omer Tachas Moshe Rabbeinu, but I'm personally dealing with him. Then there's no Machlokas, then there's a violation, but it's only within the Makom of Lishka Sagazis that he would be Chayv Misa, because that's a direct challenge to them and to the Tereshim and Moshe.
Excellent. I like that. Beautiful. It's also in the Midbar and the Torah Messiah. Lovely. Thank you, Rabbi Meir. That was a fantastic and beautiful edition. Can I turn off? Or the moment I turn off, you'll have another 300 edition.
Okay.
They'll be written intelligently, though?
Well, they
come
as an email,
so it's
the point.
Yes, that's probably a good 10-20% that I actually understand.
We can discuss that.
Okay.
It's fun. It's not this one's yet. This one's
okay, all right. It would be nice to use words the way everybody uses words, so that makes sense.
All
that must be what it is. It's keeping an infinity of meaning always available. What about the Seder? It's called humility, Barnett. It disappears with your air.
What?
Recording still. The Neil is here. Thank God.
Why specifically
in Tibra Yimba, are you going to Boaz?
Why is that related to
Tshuva? Probably because it's related to
questioning. Why that notion of questioning over others?
Because it's related to Bakosha. There's two different levels. There's simple, there's She'ila, and there's Bakosha. To be Shoel is basically only to borrow. You know, this doesn't mean that the information is mine. I'm borrowing your insight, really. That's why we often don't remember the answer to questions. You notice that? You ask somebody a question, he gives you the answer. 2 minutes later, what did he say? It's weird. Vashenka, if you give a baya, it comes to the word boyi, which means to be. This is something that I need, not something that I'm borrowing. Most of modern intercourse is borrowing. You know, I'm curious. It's interesting. I don't need it. Since I don't need it, I don't remember it when I get it. But it really is not all that important. The nature of tshuva, unfortunately, also comes very often in terms of borrowing. It's an immediate reaction to feeling uncomfortable with myself or having pains of conscience. But the idea of I need to achieve an identity that questions an underlying assumption, that's not a shayla. That's an abaya. So the nature of oven's ability to cause damage is directly nogea, this idea. I can re-examine all of the things I took for granted as an oven, which means that I am a piece of random activity in the world that makes me a bull in a china shop, speaking of the Z. That's how we refer to it. The oven essentially is a bull in a china shop, which is why we need to get him out of Gan Eden, the nature of rishus. We cannot have Adam allowing him free reign in a place like Gan Eden. It's a disaster. It's like having a chimp controlling basically the buttons on a nuclear reactor. It's mad.
Well, having access to all the science instead of being limited to specific moments.
That's the nuclear reactor. That's part of the metaphor.
Do we discuss Shabbos?
We discuss Shabbos and
Shabbos.
On Shabbos?
No, I thought that was
8 5. This is 8 6. I mixed up two of them. It all becomes a blur, especially when my mother talks to all things of the Gia all things. I mentioned that this is Echo's approach. Echo is Bilam, is my name. And he uses your approach to be mezalzel in all structure. Because what he does in his novels is he takes all things into relation with each other and shows you, therefore, that any meaning is basically just arbitrarily assigned, which is Dylan's ultimate attack. I don't say there's no meaning. I say there's so much meaning that it's all white noise. So whatever you single out as information is what you call information. The truth is, if you have this, by the way, is the why you attack, always.
There was an attack on Rebbe,
on me, exactly. Right. Unbelievable. If you have, what you're doing is you're showing us so much information that if we would take your approach to its ultimate end, then nothing could mean anything. If we really believe that things are interrelated, then we don't have any information. Therefore, we're troubled by the level of information. That's really what it boils down to. What they would do. It's what they would do. What were they? What was the actual...
There's so many possibilities.
You could find any possibility.
You go this way, you go that.
That's right. There's so many possibilities that Lamaitza, what you're doing is you're talking about levels in which you could do anything. Because there's so many possibilities, you're bound to find a possibility that links something up to something else. Right? What that does is it takes away the structure. It takes away the structure, Seder of Mishnah, and says, let's just look at all the possibilities. That's exactly what he does. By the way, that's why people can't stand Chassidus Torah. The reason people are disgusted by Chassidus Torah, Litvaks are disgusted by Chassidus Torah, is why? Because the entire approach in their learning is to discover structure. Because the more modern the learning becomes, so you go through the levels of risk learning and so on and so forth, those are all levels of learning that are responses to the modern structural ideas of science, in which the main issue of defining reality is not to explain it, but to describe it. And in the description emerges the structure that satisfies you as an explanation. It's enough that it should be so well structured. I don't need an explanation. It's a very interesting idea, right? Very interesting idea. That might put over young is a little point. Such a beautiful idea. I told you this story. He had a friend that learned Halevish Begiva in fourth grade. And he comes in with his friend. His friend's also from the Rava. So he's like, both of them are really upset. How do you explain a story like Halevish Begiva as occurring at this time in Klal Yisrael? When it's Chumash, it's stone. Right? No, he doesn't know. He didn't know it is so. But when it seems to be such a complete breakdown in like morality, how do you explain it? Fourth grade. So I said to him, okay, where else did you see Pelagic Forgiven? You know, so he thinks, and he figures out himself, it's stone. Correct. Like, that's Chumash. See, it's literally word for word stone. So I said, Okay. Who came from Stuck? The end story. Thinks about that. And says, Stuck. Correct. Now, look at Pelagius-Pergiva. Who came from Pelagius-Pergiva? He thinks and says, Shovel. His mouth opens up. Oh my gosh. So his friend says, what is it? What's the explanation? So he says, I don't know what the explanation is, but I don't need it. Amazing. It's like a conversation in fourth grade. But once you see the structure of the thing, is that you understand that whatever explanation you'll have is secondary, because always the elements. Okay, fine, I'll just say this part, I'll do that part. But the structure is so overwhelmingly clear. There's got to be a connection of this level of morality to the nature of Malchus, Malchus Tikkun. I don't know how that works. It's very mysterious, but that's amazing. You know, and that's more important than the particulars. Much more important. The structure is more important. And that's ultimately what you're... So the thing that they have against Hasidic theory is that there's no concern for structure. Because what I do is I'll take a particular thing and I'll create this beautiful, you know, gematria, or I'll say a beautiful explanation, or I'll relate the meaning of two words to each other and so on. You know perfectly well that you could have done anything with that at all, because basically it's a Martin Gardner kind of issue about the nature of coincidence, right? If there's an infinity of possible coincidences, then no coincidence is very impressive. But if you define in it, this is Ram Weinstein about the Eben Ezra and the birth of Yosef, of Yocheves giving birth on 120. If you define in advance what the coincidence is going to be, now that's awfully impressive. But if you tell me, it's like all of these people that, you know, that give predictions. Something that you have been worried about will happen on the 16th of June. Sure enough, wow, what an amazing coincidence. And so there's always levels of things that you've got. On some level, yes, that's exactly what you're going to say. That must be what was meant. Unbelievable. And everybody else, what are you, what a nut, what an idiot, how dumb can you be? And that's what they feel about us. That you're going to call Dibre Tayyar? You find some relationships, and therefore now we're supposed to applaud. I mean, there's obviously some relationship. There's an infinity of possible relationships. So you found one of an infinity of possible relationships. But why is that supposed to mean anything to you? Obviously, the difference has to be in terms of providing a structure in which this particular relationship runs across the entire matrix of a whole way in which all elements of reality interrelate with each other. This is where you get to the questions about whether the structure itself has any meaning. Is there an infinity of structure? If there's an infinity of structure, so then all Torah is Chassidus Torah. All interrelated insights, including science itself, is nothing but Chassidus Torah. And what you have is a selective vision of reality that you say makes sense because you insist that structure has to be able to stand up to experimentation or whatever it is that you design.
Generally, would be a barbanel. Why? Because they define words, and their answers are based on words. And we need the barbanel. Arbitrarily set up shot politically, we're set up like this, etc. Okay, maybe that would mean it's not that way. But refreshing the mountain are based on the words and answering based on what the sentence
is. I bet you attack the nature of language and words, and then you can even see that as being not particularly meaningful. On the contrary, you could say that the nature, the fact that words interrelate in that fashion is an insight into certain cultural or even human paradigms that force various languages into an interrelationship of words that seems to be subconscious. And that therefore, no wonder you're discovering these structures. It's not that these structures are expressed in the words, it's that the discovery of these structures is the reason that these puns exist. And you'll never be able to prove anything like that. Because words are not going to go outside of whatever evolutionary factors that there are at work in your psychology. Sure, everybody will recognize that kinship and kindness are related and that chesed has to do with monotheism. That's the same fundamental psychological problem that you have. Maybe. You cannot prove something from within the system. That's the bottom line. I mean, that's the 20th century's final whimpering end. It's the worst thing that was ever discovered. It's strange that should be called Godel. An era of Godel worship. Are you sure that that's the language? Okay. Can we stop? Or nope. Coming up here.
Maybe the speaker about the specificity of saying Rephaim Maimusha.
Specificity of?
Of using the name Rephaim of the giant Moshe.
Yeah.
As opposed to the others, but. Specificity
of Rephaim versus the other guys?
Specifically, okay. Well, why specifically Rephaim? It doesn't say Rephaim by Moshe, it doesn't appear there.
Yeah.
So, but we do see that the Rephaim are specifically used by
Moshe.
More in our parasha.
Right. It's interesting that Chazal view an Amoreth as Mishum Rafa Hatzre on the Rephaim.
That's
with
a hey,
it's not with an al. No, it relates directly in the book. It says, what happens to Mishum Rafa? That's the Vimitera. It finds himself the Eretz Rifa'im, the Darkin's the Pasuk. So, I mean, Lamaitza, the idea of not caring, that's the Marafa. In other words, the English word care and its relationship to caring is also not accidental. When you say, I care, or you have this guy carry you, obviously doesn't. But the interrelationship between the ideas is that my responsiveness is eternally a response to what is right in front of me. That was the whole hippie idea, I care with the teacher and so on and so forth. Sure you care, as long as it's not the effort of a girl, you care. You know, but as soon as you marry her, you wouldn't care. That's the whole point. So the nature of caring is defined the opposite. It's the way Bilam defines caring. Gufa through caring. So the nature of Baya, of meaning something, you know, in a way that is existentially real instead of being infatuation, is the opposite of Mithra. Approaching Torah in a way in which you can say anything that you want, you know, and you'll always come up with something to say, is viewed as Eretz Rifa'im. And it's a, this creation of Forum obviously is dependent on Sichon Va'od. Moshe can't speak until he's destroyed Sichon Va'od. He becomes an Ish Dvarim because he's destroyed Sichon Va'od. It's not that the Sichon Va'od story is unrelated to Dvarim as a whole. This is what has allowed Moshe to evolve from the Shmos Moshe to the Dvarim Moshe. Or from the Moshe that initially could not face the Nephilim to those who can face the Rephaim. Because that's how Nephilim express themselves in the Bria, in being Rifuyim, in which we even use today in modern Hebrew. The relationship to meaning is Rafah. We talk about your relationship being a loose relationship. We use that in English too. All relationships are viewed as loose. That's not the same thing as liquid within a structure. And that's exactly the problem. Sure, I can come up with a reality. Sure, and Og, by the way, obviously did that, right? I kind of, that's the way, that's why Moshe was terrified of Og. Terrified. That's because I'll say, that's why I could quote that to say, don't be afraid of him. Why was he terrified of Og? Because Og managed to survive the Milchama by Avram's time. Maybe he was the one who warned Avram about the approaching war, about Lot's capture. So Moshe was afraid, he had this because of Avram, but what does all that mean? Because Og, in having been the Palit, had figured out a way to successfully turn intelligence into Basar. Otherwise, he wouldn't have survived. What Moshe Rabbeinu had to do was successfully turn Basar into intelligence, because he's the Bishigamu Basar. The only individual in history that was Moshe Rabbeinu completely and had been successful in what he did was Og. Not Bilam. Og had successfully transmitted the idea of what his intellectual values were into something that was capable of moving his flesh like a typical human being, and to act with it in a way that wouldn't be destructive, and to be tremendously successful. The only of them appealing that was really successful. So Moshe is over. And that's why it's Mul, and that's where we learn out Mul is Oreb. In Kabbalah, Og is the Oreb of Moshe. Because he is Moshe. He's simply, he's Moshe in an alternative reality. So they appear together in the Chumash, they end together in the Chumash. It's two completely different visions of reality. One is a bottom-up vision, and one is a top-down vision. And that gets to that was the attack of Moshe Rabbeinu at Kabbalah Sefer. The same exact attack, word for word, of the Rephaim initially. The Malachim say, who the heck is Baser Adam? What's he doing here? Who needs him? What's he worth? It's no Hoskal HaShemayim. Information should exist in all of its possible permutations, not in some silly protoplasmic meat grain that's coming up here. What's he doing here at this level? That whole discussion with HaKadosh Baruch Hu at Kabbalah Taserah, the falling in love with Moshe, all of that has to do with his being able, and that the Gemara says, Shabbi Sashabi Ba'adam. If he hadn't been able to answer the Rephaim, he would not have been able to take there. But of course, there's okay. Answer them. If he hadn't answered them, then he was a failure. Same way as a failure initially. You need to be able to establish that you work from bottom up, not from top down. Otherwise, you can't have Torah. Because the end result is all you're doing is playing a Christian game. Assert binds over the weaknesses of body. Right? We today are very much in favor of the Rephaim. Why so? If basically chosen the Rephaim, they look for Malachim to be their gedolim. They turn even any human being who was b'shagam u'basar into some type of Rephaim, who has come down and established with his grand intelligence a shlita over his guf. Which is why, of course, they are the most trustworthy people in the world. I mean, you certainly would give your girl to him, wouldn't you? He could be 100% trusted not to sleep with her. When in fact, the Gemara says the exact opposite. Abaya says he couldn't trust me as far as he could throw me. So why is that? Because they don't have Abaya. They have, in fact, Malachim.
But by Moshe Rabbeinu,
not a coincidence, the Godel is Godel. You have to prove it from outside of the system, from above.
By Moshe Rabbeinu,
Moshe, all through the Chumash, has the need to having achieved what he is, to be able to be mashlit the Keach HaGuf on the Keach HaMalach instead of vice versa. As the Kabbalah says, it's more than you're not even allowed to be Yosef in it. This is a fundamental Moshe problem, is that he becomes a vision rather than a reality. This is what he's trying to address here in Dvarim. That's why he speaks personally throughout the world. His Tarkakas, not his Tarkakas about the great terrorists, it's talk about him. That's the one, the first thing he said. God said to you, let's leave. And I said, I can't handle them. I hate them. They're making me mad. Malam Hashem Tarkoni, Malam Hashem Tarkoni, Malam Hashem. And I said, I just can't go. I can't go on like this. That's the first thing he talks about. Well, he talks about yourself first thing. Tell us about this, about Kabbalah and Torah. This is the whole point of Devarim. If you're going to be able to see an application of Devarim, instead of looking at me as the Malach, how about looking at me as the human that had to become the Malach?
The Mephistosah.
Exactly. It's the idea of it. That, by the way, is the word, the meaning of the word authentic. The meaning of the word authentic, we talked about before, is the one who achieved it. It's achievement. The doer is the author. Do. Yeah, so that's what he needed. So he needed to be one who did it. So he needed to work his way up. And then having worked his way up, to have worked his way out. It's to say, okay, but you're working your way out, you no longer serve as a good example. Fine, so let's talk about how I work my way out. And then we can talk about the thing from the point of view of someone who works his way out.
And then I can be said it's most of them.
Correct. It becomes the big of the Zavarim, and that goes to truth.
And the Chaver and the Chibur is an author who want to make connections in a particular way.
He's worse than grand advice.
Rabbi Smadis said that the Rambam means that the Yehuda Nasi never wrote the Mishnah.
Of course. He was only the Sada of the Mishnah.
Made a chibur, but he wasn't
closing it. Right. Doesn't say anywhere in the Shasta. Nobody says Rabbi Yisrael Smadis sort of thing. Why would he write it?
I know that nobody is. I mean, the world makes a
mistake. No, I'm saying, I don't know of any of the Rishonim that say that Rabbi wrote it.
What does it mean, Yad
Kula? Should be the Tetula. Okay. Help me.
I've been struck by practice, they overestimate.